The Sleep Insight series invites listeners to learn about this amazing adventure we take every night called sleep. Through these insightful discussions, we examine sleep and our society's beliefs about sleep from a variety of angles. We hope you'll learn some cool new facts and analogies that you can use to help us raise awareness about this underappreciated one-third of our lives. Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen, so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness.
Welcome. My name is Marty Kaplan. I'm the director of the Norman Lear Center, which is at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, which is at USC. We're going to have a great evening. Thanks so much for coming. Tonight, Sleepless in Hollywood. Have you noticed that so many emails begin now with the catchphrase, I hope all's well with you? And I want to say, yeah, all's well with me, except for everything. So there's a lot to be sleepless about, in addition to the fact that it's a serious health issue, and we're going to be talking all about that. What is the Norman Lear Center? The answer in part is, who is Norman Lear? Just think of the shows that we associate him with, from All in the Family and Maude and the Jeffersons, Moving On Up, Sanford and Sons, all the way up to One Day at a Time, Reboot, and now A Clean Slate. Norman was all about entertainment that matters, storytelling that matters. And if I had to put the Lear Center's work in just a couple of words, it would be stories matter. Stories can fool us. They can rule us. They can help us imagine the world we want to make. They can help us make the change we want. And storytellers have power. You have power. There used to be a sign, maybe it's still there, a banner outside this building saying America's Storytellers. And that's true. You, many of you, most of you are America's storytellers. And when you tell stories, you have that power to affect what people feel and think and do. And the question always we hope everyone who has that power asks is, what will I do with that power? And Norman gave us the opportunity to study that 25 years ago. And when we began, one of the first things we did was make a partnership with the Writers Guild. So I'm thrilled that we're here tonight. That partnership has meant a great deal to us through the years. And the place where the Lear Center and the Writers Guild come together most closely is our program, Hollywood Health and Society. And it's my great pleasure to turn the floor and mic over to the director of Hollywood Health and Society. My amazing colleague and her amazing staff here will vouch for that, Kate Bull.
Welcome, everybody. Super excited to be here. Just a quick commercial on Hollywood Health and Society, and then we're going to get to the interesting stuff. Hollywood Health and Society, as Marty said, program of the USC Norman Lear Center, or it's a big mouthful. But just think HHS. And we are a free resource to writers and producers and content creators on anything to do with health, science, medicine, pro-social issues, pretty much anything. As you're researching for your stories and your scripts, You can call us, you can email us, you can come over in person, whatever you want, and we can help you research a topic, we can get information for you, we can put you on the phone or on a Zoom with experts like you're going to hear from tonight, and also people with lived experience are willing to share their stories with you. So please call us, email us, drop by. It's free, that's the optimal word. We're just here to help. We're not going to tell you how to tell your story, but we're going to help you with the facts and the information and the data. And don't we need it now? Today, I think entertainment, I was just having this conversation with someone earlier, entertainment is going to be a way, is a way, and is going to probably be more important to get our actual facts about health from our medical shows and our dramas and our comedies and all the rest of it, because we're not sure about what kind of misinformation or disinformation is around there. So we want to help you tell accurate stories when it comes to health, safety, security, and all the rest. So call us. We have operators standing by. I know nobody gets that joke anymore. But anyway, please do. We're here to help and here to serve. Now, I am so excited about this panel. I'm like, no one's going to fall asleep during this panel. I can tell you that. So you have your bio sheets, so I'm not going to give you everybody's credentials. I'm just going to say names, and then I'm going to turn it over to our moderator. We have Christopher Allen, MD, Dr. Michael Gradner, MD, Lauren Thomas, Brent Miller, and our illustrious moderator from Project Sleep, Lindsay Scola.
Thank you all so much for being here. It is just such a pleasure to be on the stage with this group of people tonight. I am a writer and a speaker myself, and in 2018, I was diagnosed with narcolepsy. And when I first heard this news come from my doctor's lips, I cocked my head and I looked at him. I was like, I don't think you're right. I've never fallen asleep into a bowl of soup. I very quickly learned that that's not what narcolepsy looked like at all, but I hadn't really seen anything on TV or film. So we are so excited to change that. I am so fortunate that I get to consult for the amazing organization Project Sleep, led by Julie Flagger, who's here with us tonight, who you're going to hear from a little bit later, and that we have this incredible partnership with Hollywood Health and Society. And we're here at the Writers Guild to talk about our favorite subject. So with no further ado, it is my great honor to introduce Dr. Gradner. He is a director of sleep at the University of Arizona, and we are so glad to have him talk to us about insomnia.
So I'm supposed to spend about 8 minutes covering about a semester long. So let me see if I can tell this story. So often reporters will ask me, why do we sleep? And I know that as a sleep scientist, I'm supposed to say, we still don't know exactly why we sleep. But that's wrong. We actually do know why we sleep. We sleep because we have to. We sleep because it's a fundamental part of our biology. We sleep because the same reason we breathe. Why do we breathe? So we don't die. Why we sleep isn't so much the question, because our need for sleep is the same as our need for breathing air, eating food, drinking water. You can make an argument for shelter, but those are the biological requirements for life. The real question they're asking is, what are all the things that sleep does? And we're learning more and more about that all the time, and why sleep is important, and why it's like, tell me something you care about, and I will tell you how sleep is related to it. I mean, even just out of my lab's research, we're looking at things like everything from depression and anxiety to cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, food, health insurance, healthcare costs and spending, things like family relationships. Like I said, pick an outcome, I will show you how it's related. Because it's foundational, because it's fundamental. Yet, we live in a society that sees sleep as an unproductive use of time. And there's nothing more un-American than an unproductive use of time. And that's where a lot of these problems come in. And so there's incentives for sleeping less. We sort of think people are harder workers and better people if they come into work really early and like stay working really late for some reason. Even though as a sleep person, I'm like, wow, I see someone. It's sort of like someone bragging about eating an entire pizza. Like, where it's like, well, I wouldn't really brag about that. You know, it's if anything, I see someone who's probably working inefficiently and making bad choices. And I can't imagine anyone in this room has ever had a bad night's sleep and knows what I'm talking about. So a little bit about insomnia. So there's a difference between insomnia and sleep deprivation. Those are two different things, very different things. Sleep deprivation is about how much sleep you're getting. It's sort of like sleep starvation. And when you're not getting the sleep your body needs, all kinds of bad things happen. We can talk about that later if you have questions. Insomnia is different. Insomnia is a different dimension. Insomnia is, irrespective of how much sleep you are getting, are you trying to sleep and not being able to? Are you struggling to sleep? Insomnia is pain. You know, where sleep deprivation might be injury, but the insomnia is the pain. Insomnia is the struggle. You can get 8 hours of sleep and have insomnia and still have that struggle. And insomnia itself, separate from sleep deprivation, is actually, I mean, it's probably the most reliable predictor of new onset mental illness, whether it's depression or anxiety disorders. It predicts new onset of those better than depression, anxiety predicts bad sleep. It also is associated with all kinds of other health outcomes, whether it's cardiovascular disease, substance use, relationship problems, you name it. Insomnia is also related to it, separate from sleep deprivation. They can overlap a lot. And so there's lots of stories about insomnia that are actually sleep deprivation, sort of the other way around. So I wanted to throw that out there. So if you're wondering about whether you have insomnia, so in the world, in the insomnia clinical world, we sort of draw a line between what I call insomnia with a lowercase I and insomnia with a capital I. Like, do you have, sort of like someone can say, oh, I'm feeling a little depressed today, but you don't have a clinical depression. You know, there's a line. And the line for insomnia is if it's taking you at least a half an hour to fall asleep, or you're awake for at least a half an hour during the night, at least three nights a week, that's sort of the line. That's the 30-33 rule. You know, it's sort of the rule of thumb we use in the field. And if it's lasted more than 3 months, it's chronic. Now, why is that important? There's two different kinds of insomnia. There's short-term insomnia and chronic insomnia. Short-term insomnia could be caused by anything. You know, evolution figured out a long time ago that if you're, you know, running from a bear in the woods, if it's bedtime, you should still keep running, right? And so we have all the insomnia is there to protect us. It's just we live in a world where we're not necessarily running from bears in the woods. We're running from deadlines and we're running from all kinds of other stresses, and that makes things complicated. So anything can cause short-term insomnia. And actually, to be totally honest, my best tip for dealing with short-term insomnia is actually do nothing. It's sort of like if you have a day where you don't have an appetite because maybe your stomach's off or something, you don't think, well, what if I starve to death? Like, or what if I have a vitamin deficiency? You think, no, I'm just going to be more hungry tomorrow. And if I'm not, well, definitely the next day, and I'll make up for it, and the system will correct itself. That's the answer for short-term insomnia. So if you've got a deadline coming up, and you're not sleeping well for a couple days, don't worry about it. Let the system correct itself. Chronic insomnia is different because chronic insomnia, so if there's a million causes of short-term insomnia, there is one cause of chronic insomnia, and it's a thing we call conditioned arousal. What that means is whatever caused you to lose sleep, if that happens and if it goes on long enough, and 3 months seems to be sort of the tipping point for most people, that sleep becomes predictably stressful. You can predict it. You don't have to think about it. You know it's going to be stressful without even consciously thinking. And so approaching sleep starts elevating your internal levels of mental and physical activation. And then you take that activation into the bed with you, which makes it harder to sleep. So sleep becomes predictably stressful. That predictable stress becomes the very activation that keeps you awake, which then strengthens the connection between sleep being predictably stressful, and it feeds itself now. The original cause, whatever got the ball rolling, is no longer relevant. The ball's rolling down the hill. Now the issue is gravity. Like, so when people say, what's the root cause of my insomnia? Usually what I say is, I actually couldn't care less, because it's irrelevant. I don't care whether the ball was pushed or shoved or kicked or leaned on heavily or whatever. It's rolling. It's moving on its own now. And so treating insomnia is more about dealing with that. It's that reprogramming process and unpairing sleep with the predictable stress and actual sort of decreasing the activation. That's dealing with the short-term issue, not necessarily the long-term issue. So I wanted to talk about insomnia versus sleep deprivation. Another thing is, so I mentioned insomnia is sometimes helpful. Another way that insomnia is sometimes helpful is I know a lot of creative people in a different life. I know some people who work in this space, and some people do their best work in the middle of the night when they're not sleeping. And for good reason. Like, the brain in the middle of the night, in a lot of ways, is stupid. You know, when you're awake in the middle of the night and your brain wants to be asleep, often this is when people are not their best selves. This is when you blow things out of proportion. This is when And then you look back on it the next day and you're like, what was I so freaked out about? Like, actually, this isn't the end of the world. And so that's a problem. This is why actually suicide spikes in the middle of the night. It's 4 times higher in the middle of the night than you would expect any other day. This is also why nobody craves a salad at 2 o'clock in the morning either. It's like the brain is, you're cognitively and affectively dysregulated. But what that also means is your brain is more open to having ideas it wouldn't have during the day. Not just the bad ideas, but sometimes some interesting ideas too. And good art can come from interesting ideas. And all I would say, and so people in the sleep world would probably tell you, like, don't do that. But what I would say is, if you're going to do that, it's sort of like being drunk, right? It's like, interesting things can happen, but don't make any major life decisions, right? And so if you know, if you're awake during the night, and you know that, like, this is when I can be really creative, let yourself do that. But don't maybe take some of these things too seriously. Jot them down, record them, speak into a thing. But, like, if you start having the thought of, like, well, maybe I should do something that, you know, something a little more drastic, don't do that. Drink responsibly. Another way to harness sleep for creativity is actually around sleep onset. Because, again, in sleep, the boundaries sort of break down, which is where dreams are such a great, rich source of information. And I want to tell you about, many people already know about this, I'm sure there are people in the room who know about this, but a very famous technique that Salvador Dali used was he would, to get these images, was he would hold a spoon over a dish, and when he fell asleep and he would lose muscle tone, the spoon would fall and it would wake him up and he would be like, okay, what was in my mind just now? I mean, I'm not saying to do that, but what I'm saying is sleep can be a very rich source of material. So I know I'm already over time, but there's plenty of time for Q&A at the end, but I do want to leave you with a couple of tips for not just stuff you can Google for how to sleep better. My 1 minute rundown of what are actual sleep tips for people who are stressed. Number one, think about your wind down routine. If you say, I'm getting into bed and I just can't turn my mind off, my question, that to me sounds like someone saying, I'm driving my car and I'm approaching the intersection and I brake, but I just can't stop my car in time and I'm braking in the intersection. So my question is, how fast were you going and when did you start braking? And if you say I was going 100 miles an hour and I started braking 2 millimeters before the stop sign, there's nothing wrong with your car or the stop sign or the road or your brakes. You need to give yourself that time and space. If you find that you're bringing that mental energy into bed with you, you just need to budget for that. It doesn't mean you have to sit in the couch and meditate for an hour. It just means you need to budget that wind down time, number one. Then once you're in bed, the best bang for your buck tip I can give you in bed is a little counterintuitive, but when you're in bed, if sleep is not imminent, get up, wait. Wait till you're sleepy. So it's like if you're sitting down to eat and you're not hungry, there's no hungry jumping jacks you can do to make yourself hungry. You just have to wait till you're hungry. And if you're in bed awake, that's what creates that programmed arousal in bed. If you're going to be awake anyway, might as well be out of bed until you're ready, then try again. Your challenge should be minimize the time awake actually spent in bed. And then the third thing is when you wake up in the morning, don't linger in bed. You might think that you want to, you really don't. Get up, get bright light, get movement. It sends a daytime signal. It will wake you up way faster than waiting for your body to be ready, and you'll have more energy during the day. Sorry for the brief version of that, but hopefully we can talk more later, and I'm also easy to find online and everywhere, so it's fine.
I like watching videos of people cleaning cast iron skillets to wind down. I'm never going to clean one myself, but I find it super relaxing. So.
Are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
Our next guest is Dr. Christopher Allen. He is a sleep medicine doctor, and he is also a patient living with sleep apnea.
Thank you very much. So before I start, I'm going to take you into Dr. Allen's office and give you a personal part of it. And what I tell my patients, I'm going to tell you, and it sounds like a cheesy commercial, but I'm going to say it anyway. Not only am I your doctor, I have obstructive sleep apnea. And I always tell them that because it humanizes me and it makes the patient know, like, okay, you've been dealing with something that I might be dealing with. And before I tell you my personal story, again, you're in Dr. Allen's office, I want to tell you about obstructive sleep apnea because people have heard about it, but they could be the CEO of a hospital organization. I'm going to talk to them like they've never heard about it before. And it's about airway collapse. You fall asleep, all the muscles in your body relax, your legs, your arms, the muscles in the back of your throat. So this is your mouth and this is the back of your throat. When you're awake, airway is open, air is going in and out, no problem. But when you fall asleep, all the muscles relax. And right in the back of your throat, it's small. And when you're sleeping and you're breathing in, this is the sound people hear. That's how snoring happens. And then it relaxes some more, and then all of a sudden, airway is closed. And so no oxygen is going to your heart, your lung, or your brain. But they don't know what's happening back there, so your heart's working harder, lungs are breathing in deeper, your brain sending stress signals all over your body, then all of a sudden, you wake up. Well, not you, your body. Sometimes you. Then you fall back asleep and it happens over and over and over again. That's obstructive sleep apnea. Now, I found out about that in my one class in my 4 years of med school. Now, they've gotten better about teaching about sleep and sleep apnea, but I had one class. When I said they got better, like, it's known that they need to talk about it more. And at that time, my friends, they were laughing at me. They was like, that is you. And I'm like, no, it's not. And just like anyone that's in school, I found like there was this opportunity that I can get some money. That was like, are you a young male that snores? I'm like, yeah, I am. It's like, well, come to this study. And so I went to this research study, and I remember I had like all this stuff on my face. I remember taking a selfie of that, or a photo, because I don't think there were selfies back then, but a photo. And I remember like going to sleep and then waking up, and I remember the sleep techs are all hovered over me, and they're like, yeah, you have obstructive sleep apnea. And so I'm like, oh, I was like, okay. And the thing is that when, and there's many ways to treat obstructive sleep apnea. I always tell patients that. But the way that I used is CPAP therapy, which stands for continuous positive airway pressure. And that last word is the most important part, pressure. Wear a mask and you keep your airway open. So no more snoring and you're getting quality sleep. Now I started using it and I'm like, all right, I guess I'm using it and it's fine. And then I'm like, well, I guess it's working. But then I went on a trip about 3 months in, and I didn't take my CPAP with me. I'm like, I'm not going to lug that thing. And I felt horrible. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe it's something about this, you know, sleep apnea and getting treated. And at that time, that led me being passionate to want to get into being a sleep doctor. I'm also a pediatric neurologist, but I didn't know I could be a sleep doctor until I found out about it. And I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. And that's, you know, I love neurology, but sleep is my passion. And where I was before, you know, I was that guy that was falling asleep in class. I was that guy that was like rushing to like go over the material again. I was like, well, maybe I'm lazy. What's going on? And then afterwards, you know, it's like hindsight. I always tell my patients, I have a hindsight appointment. Where you come back, I'm like, huh, I'm not falling asleep in class anymore. And, you know, people want to share the room with me because, like, on high school trips, it's like, no, I'm not staying with Chris. He snores. And I remember, like, my mom yelling. It's like, turn off your back. And, you know, little things. So there was always there. And you feel bad because you think about, wow, this is going on for so long. But I was telling my patients, like, there's no time like the present. And so it became a part of me. It was just a regular part of my life. And when I was in residency, I had my little duffel bag with my CPAP because I knew I wanted to get sleep. And sometimes if I was able to, like, not be on call, where they literally, back then, they were having in the hospital for over 24 hours making medical decisions. And you might get 2 hours of sleep. And so, but if I did, I made sure to put my CPAP on. To make sure, because like my attending was going to grill me. He's like, well, do you know about this? Like, sir, I only slept 2 hours. I would never tell him that personally, but that's what I was thinking in my head. And so that's where it is after. And, you know, I've been using it for, because it's funny, March is Sleep Awareness Month. And coincidentally, that's when I started using CPAP therapy. So I'm 21 years in. And I noticed the difference with it. And I'm so fortunate where I hear my patients and they notice the difference. And where there's so many things that it lead to. And when you guys have questions, we can get more into that. But seeing them come off of medication, seeing them having their weight facilitated, like with weight loss, seeing their mood get a lot better, getting them to be more creative, and it's just a regular part of their life. And so I can say personally, I'm so glad that I know I have obstructive sleep apnea, that I can treat patients with obstructive sleep apnea, and more important, that I'm treated so I can help other people get treated as well. Thank you very much.
And I highly recommend following Chris on social media, where he will also tell you that wearing a CPAP is very sexy.
So true.
As someone who wears an oral appliance, my husband will also tell you snoring versus not snoring, very sexy.
Definitely.
I'm so happy to introduce Lauren, who outside of myself might be one of my other favorite people with narcolepsy, and tell you a little bit about herself.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. So my narcolepsy journey started when I was 15, though at the time I just thought I was really unmotivated and severely depressed. My mom can still remember driving me to school, and I'd be asleep before we even left the driveway. There were times I couldn't even remember getting in the car to go to school. No one thought I had a sleep disorder. I was already under the care of a psychiatrist and a psychologist. 13 years old, I had already moved through 2 states. By 17, I'd already had 3 major knee surgeries. I was an elite basketball player. I was hoping to play D1, maybe even go pro, but those sure surgeries shattered those dreams. That was all really tough to deal with, but on top of that, I was exhausted all the time. No matter how much I slept, I felt like I was dragging myself through the day, while everyone else seemed to be able to balance their academics and extracurriculars. Every time I brought it up to my doctor, all I kept hearing was, "You're depressed." So what did I do? I was an overachieving teenager. I blamed myself. Maybe I wasn't disciplined enough. Maybe I just needed to push through. Or maybe I was just lazy. I wasn't lazy. I had undiagnosed narcolepsy. At my super competitive private school, I felt like I was failing at academics and athletics. I had amazing friends, a supportive family. But I was sneaking naps in the bathroom stalls and in my car just to make it through the day. Even my guidance counselor let me nap in her office. There were so many adults around me that enabled my sleeping, but no one referred me to a sleep specialist. When I got to college, things were even worse. My sleepiness was out of control, but I was also having nightmares, sleep paralysis, hallucinations, and these weird things where I'd collapse whenever I felt panicked. At first, I thought, maybe I'm just a really bad student. Socially, I was really thriving, but academically, it was a disaster. Without a diagnosis, I had no accommodations. No one really understood why I couldn't make my morning classes, and my grades didn't match my intelligence. I was on and off academic probation, not because I wasn't capable, but because I physically couldn't get out of bed to get to class. And that wasn't the worst part. My sleepiness to most seemed convenient. I had no energy for class, but somehow I had plenty of energy to make a tailgate. That didn't really help my case when I told people that I had thought something was wrong with me. After college, I was living in New York, and I was commuting into the city every day. I'd always wake up to the conductor telling me it was the last stop on the train, and I had slept through my entire commute. At work, I was sneaking naps in the bathroom just to function. At one point, I even moved to Manhattan to cut down on my long commute, thinking the extra sleep would help. It didn't. I had a great boss who saw that I was struggling, and she offered me medical leave to take some time to figure things out. During that time, I saw so many doctors and tried every health hack imaginable, acupuncture, TMS, infrared saunas. If someone was doing it on Instagram, I probably tried it. Most doctors were dismissive. They saw a black woman with a mental health history, and they kept telling me to diet and exercise. I finally saw an endocrinologist who suggested a sleep study. In January of 2019, 15 years after my symptoms started, I was diagnosed with narcolepsy. My first thought was, I'm not like Mr. Bean in Rat Race. I'm not like Rob Schneider's girlfriend in Deuce Bigelow. I had seen narcolepsy in movies my whole life, but I never thought that that could be me. So real quick, here's what narcolepsy actually is. Symptoms begin with excessive daytime sleepiness. Imagine feeling like you've been awake for 72 hours straight every single day. That's what it's like living with narcolepsy. Cataplexy. That sudden muscle weakness when you feel strong emotions. There was one time where I was trying to swallow pills and one got lodged in my throat. I was hunched over my kitchen counter trying to get this pill down, panicking, when all of a sudden my arms went limp and my head bobbed, hit the table, 16 stitches later. That's how I discovered that my cataplexy is related to panic. The next symptoms are sleep paralysis and hallucinations. If you've ever woken up and you can't move and you see a terrifying sleep demon in the corner of your room, that's a very large symptom of narcolepsy. The final symptom is disrupted nighttime sleep, because of course you're going to be tired all the day, but you can't sleep at night either. Even with a diagnosis, it really hasn't been easy. I was hospitalized for asthma a few years ago. My care team did not understand narcolepsy. I assumed that when I disclosed that I had narcolepsy during our intake, that they would understand because they were doctors. But when they were doing rounds at night and I was sleeping, I was in a sleep paralysis episode. The resident assumed that I was unresponsive, started doing sternum rubs, which are very hard, almost fist-like compressions on your sternum to arouse an unconscious person. And he also directed the nursing staff to search my belongings for drugs, because apparently having a sleep disorder is criminal. It was humiliating, and it showed me that even in medical settings, people with rare diseases often have to educate their own doctors just to get proper care. Despite all these challenges, I'm grateful. I finally have a diagnosis, a treatment plan, and a community that understands. But I spent 15 years thinking that I was lazy, undisciplined, and broken because no one thought to look deeper. That's why I share my story, because there are so many others out there. Women, especially Black women, are often misdiagnosed, dismissed, or ignored. And we need to tell stories that reflect real experiences and not just movie punchlines. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. As somebody with cataplexy that is also triggered by panic, I am an intermediate skier who is afraid of intermediate hills, so I have my worst cataplexy when skiing, which I don't recommend. You can't joke about that, what can you? So about 10 years ago, The Simpsons did a story where Homer was diagnosed with narcolepsy. Julie Flagar happened to find out about this on the internet and reached out to the writer and showrunner of The Simpsons, Al Jean, and was able to make sure that Homer had a better experience with his diagnosis with narcolepsy. Al unfortunately couldn't join us in person tonight, so we were able to film this conversation earlier.
Kirk Burns pitched it as the opening, and we wanted to do an episode that had dreams within dreams, so we thought it fit the structure. And at Comic-Con that year, I mentioned, because it was going to be the season premiere and Lena Dunham was going to play a woman who worked at a pharmacy who, in Homer's dream, became his girlfriend, that it was going to be the premiere, and I mentioned that narcolepsy was a part of the plot. And then Julie, who I didn't know, tweeted and just said, "Certainly hope that you're taking it seriously and that you're, you know, portraying narcolepsy accurately, as sitcoms often don't." And I said, "That's a good point." So I really took it seriously. And we changed the show, in fact, to, you know, Homer didn't get the medicine and didn't take it, and so he wasn't treating it properly. And Marge, because of all the stuff that's in the relationship, not just the fact that he was sick, says, "I need a separation for a while." And he said, "Marge, you know, narcolepsy is a serious disease." And then Marge says, "Maybe you didn't take it seriously enough." And that line was put in thanks to Julie. And I'm Homer in that scenario where I didn't take it seriously enough, but I certainly did after I heard about it.
I mean, I think for me, I saw that, you know, Homer was going to get narcolepsy in the season premiere. And I got really afraid, I guess, because often it's shown as a character quirk or a put down that someone has narcolepsy. And often it's really not seen as like a real medical condition in a lot of shows. And the portrayals of narcolepsy often like mirror past portrayals that people don't do their own independent research to really understand the condition and, you know, the current treatment options. So it was, ended up being really cool that, you know, you had included the scientific names of, you know, the neurotransmitters that are related to narcolepsy, and some of the current treatment options were mentioned in the episode. And so that was just a really different approach to narcolepsy, that it was like fresh research, current knowledge of narcolepsy included in the episode.
I'm so happy we did it. And, you know, it's now, you know, with the internet and with the way you can research anything, there is no excuse for not really understanding, you know, what you're talking about. And I appreciate you for setting us straight.
Well, I mean, I think that was the other thing, is that your willingness to engage with the community was so different. You know, we'd had other shows that were including characters with narcolepsy, and they would never engage on social media. I think it's out of fear that like we're going to make it worse or something, that we're going to say, and like you were so open that like we could help make it more interesting.
To me, you're never too old to learn anything. And you know, that's the point of growth. I mean, and that's what we try to show. And so also there's, you know, being a little immodest, when something's in The Simpsons, a lot of kids tend to see it. So you are planting the seed of what people know about something. You know, it's the first time they may have heard a reference to narcolepsy or anything, you know, in their lives. So I do take it seriously.
So back when I got diagnosed with narcolepsy, I realized that I didn't know anything about narcolepsy. And so when I try to like think back of things that I wish that I had seen, Lauren very eloquently talked about hallucinations. Mine were mostly audio, or still are, but I would like regularly hear like a small child asking to hold my hand. And I was awake at 3 o'clock in the morning because of the fractured sleep. I lived in a little bungalow in Echo Park, so it was probably a yes and situation on the haunting. But I wish that I had seen something about this sort of bizarre thing that happens with narcolepsy, because it's so fascinating. But also, I didn't know that not everyone has sleep paralysis every 6 or 7 weeks. So I have a question for all of you. What's something that you wish that you had seen, or wish that you could see now on TV about sleep or your disorder?
One of the things that I realize in sleep, and we've all been conditioned to it, and I tell this to my patients, when you watch, like, growing up and you see a cartoon and somebody's sleeping, it's like, oh man, they're really asleep. You would just see them, bellies going up and down, and you see those little Z's going, meaning that they're snoring. And with me, after leaving my fellowship, you know, I've learned that snoring is not normal. As I was mentioning earlier, if you're snoring, that means your airway is collapsing and you're producing that vibratory sound, meaning that you're not getting enough oxygen. Now, if you're snoring, does that mean you have a sleep disorder? Not necessarily. But if you wake up and you don't feel like you're alert, then there could be a sleep disorder. And I wish that, like, you know, but when you see people on TV, there's like, oh, look, they're nice and sleep. Look at them. And you just see them snoring. But that's something that's not normal. And so when people look at that, it's like, oh, no, he's just sleeping really hard. You know, so that was like one of the things. And then, as you were mentioning, yeah, people, you know, first you're going to look to yourself, like, what can I do to sleep or sleep better or get to sleep? And people will try to self-medicate. It's like, oh, if I drink, I'll go to sleep. Or if I take a gummy or take a hit, you know, I'll go to sleep. And true, you might fall asleep. But what it does, it's like taking a cleaver and chopping up your sleep. And so it actually breaks up your sleep. And so you're not even getting the good quality sleep that you need. And they've shown studies just to show the accuracy of like you going through your certain sleep stages, and it's not, you're not getting that quality from it. So it's always asking that question, like, okay, if it's so bad where I feel like I need to take something, then you should talk to a provider. And I wish they would show some of that more, you know, within film and TV.
Well, just to iterate off of that, what a lot of people don't realize about sleep is that there's three systems in the brain that control whether you're awake or asleep, and they're separate from each other and they work together. There's the circadian system that tells you whether it's daytime or nighttime, where even if you're really tired, if your body knows it's daytime, you're less likely to fall asleep than even if you're not super tired, but it's nighttime. So there's a 24-hour circadian cycle. There's the sleep system, which is sort of like, you know, think of it as like hunger for food. You have this hunger for sleep that the only thing that builds it is being awake. The longer you're awake, you build up a hunger for sleep, and as you sleep, that energy dissipates. The third system is the wake system. This is the system that wakes you up, alerts you, and maintains that wakefulness. And a key part of this is that the sleep system and the wake system are two separate systems. It's not that you have awake on one end and asleep on the other on one line. It's actually two-dimensional. You can be high on both, low on both, or they're supposed to work together. But often the issue with insomnia is not insufficient sedation. Usually your sleep drive is, in people with insomnia, their sleep drive is fine. They just have so much activation with the wake signal being overly active that, I mean, sure, if you douse with a sedative, you can overpower it. But the problem wasn't that you were insufficiently sedated. The problem is you were too activated. And reducing the activation and increasing sedation are two separate processes. That's why that reprogramming stuff that I was talking about works. It outperforms medications because that's actually solving a lot of the problems with insomnia. And that's why a lot of the self-medication people get very frustrated with. And like you were saying, it's a lot of times you take it, it changes your sleep, and not necessarily always for the better. But I also want to very briefly mention melatonin. Melatonin is different. Melatonin is not sedative at all, actually. It tells your body it's nighttime. It's a circadian process, a circadian signal. And it's so not sedative, you give melatonin to a nocturnal animal, it wakes them up because it tells them it's nighttime. And the reason why it does not work for insomnia is because most people with insomnia, their body already knows it's nighttime, still can't sleep because they're too activated. That's why anyone you talk to is like, oh, I took melatonin, it didn't really do anything. That's why. It can help with sleep by boosting that nighttime signal. But actually, the paradox is the worse your sleep is, the less likely it's going to help. But, I mean, I don't know what you...
And just to piggyback off of that, like, even with melatonin, like, we all make it. And if you take it at the wrong time, it can actually make you stay up. And so a lot of people's like, yeah, I can sleep, so I pop more melatonin. And I'm like, okay, I'm glad you're telling me that, because we're going to stop that. And then, like, find a way to actually figure out the root cause of what's, like, making them not go to sleep. Or seeing, like, or what's waking them up in the middle of the night, because, you know, is it really insomnia? And sometimes, like, well, I'm just waking up in the middle of the night, and we find out that they have sleep disorder, like obstructive sleep apnea, and then get it treated. Or, and sometimes you talk to your bed partner. There's a woman that I saw, thought she had, you know, insomnia, but no, it was her husband keeping her up snoring. So he saw me, I treated her, and lo and behold, she's sleeping a lot better. So it's always like those questions you want to ask, and it's always vital to ask like the bed partner of yours, because they'll give you more sleep, like information about your sleep, than you ever will. And it's funny because in my office, I'll have the bed partner questionnaire, and if the bed partner's there, I'm talking to them most of the, like, yeah, so yeah, I hear what you're saying. So you're saying he's snoring, right? So yeah, that's what happens.
Not just hitting your significant other with a pillow. That's not...
We call those love taps.
Lauren, what do you wish that you had seen on TV?
So what I wish I would have seen on TV was, I feel like, you know, when I started going through all this when I was a teenager. And I feel like, you know, it's like you see a teenager sitting in the back of class, falling asleep, not able to stay awake in class, and they're reprimanded. They're sent to the principal's office, they're sent to detention, their parents are called, and it's more of a disciplinary issue and not a let's seek and find out what's going on issue. And if it is a let's seek and find out going on, it's normally the mental health lane. So I think I wish I would have seen someone that was struggling the way I was, and they were offered a sleep consult. I didn't know that that existed. I didn't know that that was a specialty of medicine. So I think Same. Just even knowing that that was a possibility would have saved me a lot of time and money.
And yeah. It's funny, I didn't even know that, like, I'm a sleep doctor, and I didn't know it was a sleep doctor until I was actually, like, in residency. I was like, wait a second, like, I just saw, like, lung doctors take
it
over.
Exists.
Right. And it's a beautiful thing that I found. And I think, you know, for the field of sleep medicine, you know, that's why, like, I kind of, like, do social media, like, with shameless plug, Sleep Dr. Chris. Look it up, you find me, like and follow. But when I do that, it's just, like, putting sleep out there, make sleep cool, making sure people know about that, just to say, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, and I'll get comments, say, yeah, my boyfriend does that, yeah, my mom noticed that. And it's just putting that awareness out there.
Sleep isn't the thing getting in the way of us being able to stay up longer and do more fun things. Sleep is our ally. Sleep is a joy. During sleep, this is when your brain and your body take the experiences of the day and integrate them and make them who you are. It becomes your experiences, your memories, how you feel about things. It helps you see the world the next day as efficiently, clearly, and helps you enjoy the day more. Sleep isn't like, I would love to see on TV somebody who is actually not praised for staying up late and working hard. Like, I would love to, you know, someone's boss says, no, actually, get some sleep, you'll do better. Or when someone's trying to have insomnia, instead of just taking a pill as some sort of visual cue for treating their insomnia, that they're actually doing the things that are recommended, like, you know, like some of the behavioral sleep medicine stuff that we could talk about. Yeah, I think, like, so people don't know what a sleep study is. I mean, the most recent data I've seen about sleep apnea, for example, is that about one out of every four or five men over age 30 probably has at least mild sleep apnea. And for women, it's less common, but you're still talking about one out of every maybe 15 or 20 women. That's a lot. I mean, there's more than 20 women in this room. You know, and I think that the normalization that sleep issues are pretty common, and what do you do when you have sleep issues besides just complain about it? Go see somebody. And there's actually people who know what they're doing. And that would be great to see and have those stories. I mean, plus sleep is so cool. You can talk about sleep paralysis. There's all kinds of fun stories in there.
Remember that at least one in five people have a sleep disorder. They're only diagnosed at around 20% of those folks. So there are a lot of undiagnosed folks who really need to see these stories on TV. Thank you all so much for coming.
The Project Sleep Podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.